This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, October 15th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. In 1973, the Supreme Court issued its ruling on the case of Roe v. Wade. In a 7-2 decision, Justice Harry Blackmun wrote that the Constitution protects a woman's right to choose to terminate a pregnancy. Nearly 50 years have passed, and abortion rights have become a fixture of American politics. Republicans consistently promise to appoint anti-abortion judges, and conservative activists push cases involving reproductive rights to the Supreme Court in the hope of securing a decision that will overturn Roe. If the Senate confirms Amy Coney Barrett, the Supreme Court will include 6 justices appointed by Republicans. During her confirmation hearings this week, Barrett, a devout Catholic who clerked for Justice Antonin Scalia, stonily evaded every question about how her personal beliefs might affect her legal decisions. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California lamented Barrett's evasiveness during an exchange about Roe v. Wade and another landmark abortion rights case, Planned Parenthood v. Casey.
So on something that is really a major cause with major effect on over half of the population of this country, who are women, after all, it's distressing not to get a straight answer. So let me try again. Do you agree with Justice Scalia's view that Roe was wrongly decided?
Senator, I completely understand why you are asking the question, but again, I can't pre-commit or say, yes, I'm going in with some agenda, because I'm not. I don't have any agenda. I have no agenda to try to overrule Casey. I have an agenda to stick to the rule of law and decide cases as they come.
Margaret Talbot, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the future of abortion rights in the United States and what strategy Democrats should pursue to protect those rights in the coming years. Margaret, welcome back.
Hi, Dorothy. Nice to be here.
So glad to have you. Barrett's stonewalling was no surprise. You know, she was following the standard tactic of recent nominees to the court on abortion rights and other politically fraught issues, including the Affordable Care Act. Yet we know from her record what she believes on abortion rights and how she's likely to decide cases. Could you just give us a brief recap?
Sure. I mean, actually, I think of all of the nominees to the Supreme Court, of all of the justices in recent years, maybe since Robert Bork, there's nobody who has sort of a clearer record on an issue, in this case, abortion, that she's likely to be ruling on than Amy Coney Barrett does. For one thing, her personal views are quite clear. She signed a letter that appeared as a newspaper ad in a South Bend, Indiana newspaper in 2006, denouncing Roe v. Wade and referring to its barbaric legacy and defending the right to life from fertilization to natural death. She also joined a faculty pro-life group when she was a law professor at Notre Dame. And this was brought to my attention by reading the wonderful SCOTUS blog. She also signed a letter criticizing the ACA's mandate to cover contraception and specifically criticizing the compromise that the Obama administration offered of allowing religious institutions to opt out. But she signed a letter saying that it was an insufficient compromise. So, you know, her personal views, I think, are manifestly clear. She does not have a very long record on the bench. She was appointed to the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in 2017, but she does have 2 abortion-related cases that she ruled on, both of them having to do with restrictive laws that I think were both signed into law by then-Governor Pence in Indiana. One of them mandated that fetal remains from miscarriage or abortion undergo burial, and the other placed a ban on abortions for certain reasons, including fetal abnormalities. And the second law had to do with parental notification. It required parental notification, but it did not have what most states have in their parental notification laws, which is a judicial bypass, allowing people who don't have parents that they can appeal to for one reason or another for consent to get a judge to approve of their decision to have an abortion if they're a minor. Anyway, both of those laws, aspects of them had been overturned by a 3-panel judge of the court, and Barrett wanted them to be reconsidered by the full court, suggesting that she thought the decision to overturn those bans was incorrect.
In Roe, seven justices ruled that the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment included an implicit right to privacy for women who were deciding whether to terminate a pregnancy. In the Barrett hearing, when she did mention Roe, she said that unlike Brown versus Board of Education, it wasn't a super precedent. What did she mean by that?
Yeah, she has a very, I think, limited list of what she would call super precedents, which are rulings by the Supreme Court that she thinks if you overturned them would be too disruptive. It would overturn expectations, ways of life, value systems that people had embraced for so long that it would be kind of disastrous, catastrophic to overturn them. In some of her writings, she's included things like paper money, you know, the idea that there would be things that even if they weren't stipulated in the Constitution as an originalist like her would want them to be, at this point, they're too accepted. They're too much part of the fabric of life. As you say, she made an exception for Roe, even though Roe is now almost 50 years old and certainly a part of the expectations for most women that they will have legal access to abortion in the United States.
Also, a majority of Americans support Roe, and like it or not, the court of public opinion does influence the decisions of the Supreme Court. And we saw in the previous term that Chief Justice John Roberts really surprised many people by joining the liberals in several key cases, including one dealing with Trump's financial records. Tell us about the first case on abortion rights the court will likely hear this term.
Well, you know, they've already heard one case, not a full hearing, but they had to decide whether to allow some rules that governed medication abortion during the pandemic to stand. Basically, there had been a lower court that said that one aspect of the FDA protocol for using abortion pills could be lifted during the pandemic because it was a public health emergency. And that's a rule that requires women to come in to pick up the first dose of the pills in person, which is a rule that most major medical organizations and many doctors have made clear is not necessary for health reasons. But anyway, a lower court judge had upheld that lifting of that restriction during the pandemic, and the Trump administration appealed it, and the court declined to hear that case. So it is still the case that women do not have to show up in person to get their initial dose during the public health emergency. But many people think that that will be a case that will return to the court when Barrett is on it. There are about 17 other, you know, abortion restrictions, some of them quite restrictive, some of them from southern states, really outlawing abortion almost altogether or at a very early point in pregnancy, and a variety of other kinds of restrictions that are in the appeals courts now and could come to the court this term, certainly will come in the next couple of terms.
I was interested in a piece you wrote a couple of months ago about something called the Turnaway Study, which periodically checked in over the course of a decade with, as I recall, over 1,000 women who had sought abortions in 2007. What were the study's findings?
It was really a remarkable study just because it was so large and it followed people over such a long period of time. And it basically found that most women did not regret having had abortions. Many of them had really demonstrable improvements in their life as a result of having had abortions when they chose to have them. So that included more economic stability, more likelihood that they would have a partner they said they were satisfied with, more likely that they would have more positive relationships with the children they did have, and a number of other factors, including maternal health. And also, it reiterated the safety of abortion as a procedure in the United States.
This week, Senator Gary Peters of Michigan spoke very candidly about his family's experience with abortion some decades ago. And I think in the heat of these debates, people often overlook the women who desperately want the baby, but for health reasons have to choose the procedure. So in the late 80s, Peters' wife needed an abortion for medical reasons, turned away by the first hospital. They had to travel to another, which they credit with saving her life. And Peters went on MSNBC to talk about the experience.
Women, what they go through in losing a child and the anguish they go through, I experienced it firsthand with my wife. And it's the whole family, it's husbands, it's other loved ones. These are decisions that need to be made by a woman. They are incredibly difficult, hard decisions. They need to be made with the advice of a physician and the medical advice and folks that the woman may want to bring into that decision.
Margaret, I was struck by this, the would-be father of an unborn child describing the agony of that decision. Why do we so rarely hear this side of the story about families that want to keep the child but cannot?
Well, you know, I thought that was so powerful, not only for the reason that you explained, and I think many people are reluctant to come forward because it's private. These are sorrowful, difficult experiences, and they may not want to talk about it, or they may not want to experience the blowback or the trolling or whatever they may get from coming forward. But the other thing that really struck me about his statement was actually how few men, who often are very much part of the decision, part of the ambivalence or regret and share that with their partner, but also very much support the decision and feel it's the right one for them and a help to both them and their families and their future lives. And it was really, really powerful, I think, to hear that from a man. And I do wish we heard more from men who were involved in those decisions and whose lives are affected as well.
Do you think it's effective in political terms? So many people who are pro-choice feel, rightly, I think, uncomfortable with abortion. It's a very, very tough, emotionally fraught subject. Does a plea like Peters's make inroads with people who are vacillating, who have trouble with this issue?
I think so, because I think it kind of brings home the reality of difficult decisions that people have to make, but that in the end, I think most people want those individuals to be able to make, not the legislators, not the Supreme Court.
Not hospital boards.
I mean, those kind of heartfelt stories and people telling them frankly and people talking about the difficulty of the decision, I think just tells us that these are human dilemmas, but we do want human beings, individuals whose lives are going to be deeply, deeply affected by these decisions to be able to make them for themselves and their families.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
There was another public statement that I found particularly interesting this week. It was by Elise Hoag, the president of NARAL Pro-Choice America, who admitted on the Daily podcast that abortion right advocates have taken Roe for granted too much and that they've failed to forcefully counter Republican attacks. How do you account for that failure beyond the intimidation factor you mentioned a moment ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a strange kind of way, it reminds me a little bit of vaccination and the way the sort of anti-vaccine movement appeared out of nowhere, because it was a lot of people who didn't remember, hadn't had direct experience, thanks to vaccination, of what it was like to have to deal with infectious diseases as we're dealing with now. But, you know, sweeping away generations of children or threatening your way of life. And it's been a while since abortion was illegal, and a lot of people don't have direct experience or direct memories. You know, some people do because they live in states where it's so difficult to get them that they are facing access issues that are comparable to before Roe. But, you know, I think that that lack of recent experience or memory of what it's like when you actually do really need an abortion and can't get one has been important in kind of undermining support in recent years.
And you mentioned that in many states, it's become more and more difficult to obtain an abortion. Could you elaborate on that a little bit, what the pro-life movement has been doing in recent decades to restrict those rights?
Yeah, I mean, they have tried really a variety of strategies. I have to say, I think the pro-life movement has been very inventive and very energetic in coming up with different ways of restricting the basic right to abortion. You know, one of the more effective attempts anyway, although it's been turned back at the Supreme Court, are TRAP laws is the acronym for them. And they are laws that require abortion clinics to have certain kinds of regulations that are not needed to provide abortions and that are not imposed on other kinds of clinics. So one of them involves having the doctors performing the abortions must have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals, which can be quite difficult because a lot of hospitals don't want to give admitting privileges to doctors who perform abortions. And in general, they're not necessary for most abortions. So one of those laws, the Texas law, was overturned in the Supreme Court. A Louisiana law that tried to do the same thing was overturned last term by the court, somewhat surprisingly, but mainly because they had already ruled on this case in Texas. And so Justice Roberts decided to overturn this Louisiana court on the basis of this precedent that the court had set a few years earlier when Anthony Kennedy was still on the court. You know, there are other kinds of restrictions, like the laws I mentioned, the Indiana laws I mentioned, you know, parental consent laws, laws meant to just sort of discourage women from seeking abortions or sometimes, I think, humiliate or shame them when they are seeking abortions, like requiring them to look at ultrasounds of the fetus, requiring them to hear some medically suspect information about the risks of abortion and the psychological risks of abortion, which have not been scientifically corroborated. So there are a whole variety of methods that kind of chip away at the fundamental right established in Roe.
It's also incredible at this late date that birth control is still a subject of dispute. In Griswold v. Connecticut, a decision that predated Roe, the court ruled that the Constitution protects the liberty of married couples to use contraception. This week, top fertility doctors opposed Barrett's nomination, arguing that she might rule against access to contraception and fertility treatments. Is it possible that Griswold is in jeopardy?
You know, I would be a little dubious about that, but I do think that the ACA mandate for contraception is still in play. So the affordability of contraception, the ability of people to access contraception is still an issue. And as I mentioned, Barrett signed this letter criticizing the ACA compromise on contraception. So I think that is potentially an issue.
What role can the states play in protecting the rights of women and men to make their own decisions about how and when to start their families?
I'm glad you said "and men." Yeah, something interesting has happened in the last few years, which is that in anticipation of a turnover at the Supreme Court and in response to the Trump presidency and the perceived threat to abortion rights, a number of states, I think it's now about 20, have passed some kind of law, sometimes incorporating new language into their state constitutions, sometimes with a statute or a court ruling, protecting the right to abortion in that state. So that even if Roe v. Wade were to be overturned, you would still be able to have an abortion if you lived in one of those states. And they include several states in the West, California, Washington, Oregon, several states in New England, Illinois significantly, because Illinois is actually surrounded by a lot of states that do not have such protections and have restrictive abortion laws. So, you know, those may become sort of sanctuary states that people can get to if they can manage it, if they can afford it, to get abortions if abortion became illegal or very, very restricted by the Supreme Court. So that's been a very important development in the last few years.
Thanks so much, Margaret.
Thank you.
Margaret Talbot is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of The Entertainer, Movies, Magic, and My Father's 20th Century. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron, Michelle Moses, and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.